This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is April 8th, 2021, and this is episode 234.
I'm Scott Lundeboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we speak to the newest candidate in the race for the BC Liberal leadership, Gavin Dew. Plus, we have a crossover that Scott recently did with the Unbound podcast.
Yeah, they're another local politics podcast, talking about things from a bit more of a right-of-center perspective, but I've been quite enjoying listening to their stuff. I did about an hour-long discussion with them on their podcast about municipal politics, housing, all that good stuff. We'll throw a link in the show notes. That should be going out probably tomorrow around the same time this episode releases. So give that a listen. And we have a brief discussion later on in the episode with them here talking kind of the future of the center-right in BC and Canada.
And as always, thank you to the 101 people who contribute to keep the show going every month. Thank you to our newest patrons, Mike and Joe, for signing up and signing back up, and to Jack for upping their pledge. And a special, I'm disappointed in you, to Reneal, for canceling your pledge. I don't usually call out people who delete their pledge. I don't judge them, but I'm judging you, Reneal. Support the podcast at patreon.com/politicoast. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's jump into our first segment, Do the Do with Gavin Dew. Let's throw it over to the interview we just recorded.
Joining us is BC Liberal leadership candidate Gavin Dew. Gavin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So, might as well start off with an introduction. Who are you and why are you running?
Yeah, you bet, Scott. So, name's Gavin Dew, born and raised in Vancouver, grew up here. I've got two kids, Abigail, who's 2 years old, coming up on three, and Evan, who's just over 4 months old. Before recording this, I actually just ran upstairs in between calls to eat dinner in 5 minutes and kiss my kids. So, you know, I'm obviously pretty focused on that in my day-to-day life as a dad with my wife, Erin. I'm a business person professionally, and now I'm running to lead the BC Liberal Party. And the reason I'm doing that, you know, ties in very much to that family component. Really, for me, it's about making sure, obviously, that my kids have a bright future in BC, but also that other people and families are well set up. And I really do believe that our party needs to, you know, to refocus around people and families. I think we need to really fundamentally renew our party, and I think we need to build a bridge to the next generation of voters.
Congrats on the young family. I have an 18-month-old myself, and it's exhausting. Running for leader is a huge jump, especially with young kids. I remember when John Horgan became leader, there was talk of like David Eby running, but he was like, no, I have young kids. I have no time to do that. And now he's attorney general, which I imagine is just as busy. But for you, why make the jump directly to try to be leader of the party and not, you know, do the traditional path of trying to get into the legislature, build some political experience, and so forth?
Yeah, those are a few good questions in there, Ian. Firstly, congratulations both on having a kid and on surviving this far. You're obviously, you're doing okay. You look like you've got bags under your eyes. We can see each other, so we know that we're both tired dads. But, you know, you're absolutely right. It is a really, really big, challenging trade-off, and it's a challenging sacrifice. But, you know, truth of the matter is, things aren't easy for young families in BC right now. So it's not like I'm expecting this to be easy for me, but, you know, there's a whole heck of a lot of us that are struggling and that are, you know, trying to get by and trying to, you know, to believe that we can make it here. So I'm not expecting this to be an easy ride whatsoever. I know there's going to be a lot of hard work involved. I know there's a lot of sacrifice involved, and I know it's going to take a toll. It's something that I thought about long and hard before I jumped in, had a lot of conversation, you know, with my wife and with my family about how we're going to move forward and do this. And, you know, ultimately it helps that, frankly, I'm running on a platform that is focused on people and families. I mean, the connection between kind of my personal life and what I'm doing politically is pretty direct. You know, I'm a big believer that if you're in politics, you can't have some giant difference between who you are personally, privately, and who you are publicly. So it makes it pretty easy for me to kind of always know what my North Star is and why I'm doing this. So, you know, that's part of the motivation around family. Everyone struggles with that in politics. I think, to be perfectly honest, we don't make it that easy for folks to be in politics who have families. And I think in particular, it's exceedingly difficult for women to get into politics and to deal with those challenges around family. That's something that that I know secondhand through my wife Erin's experience on the Vancouver Park Board, how tough it is. She actually ran for city council with a 3-month-old, and it was tough, but I think it is necessary, and I think it's worthwhile. Ian, just to answer your question around why go do this now, I think fundamentally, I think our party needs it, and I think our province needs it. It's high time that there's a leader in BC politics who, you know, respects young people every day of the week, not just when there's an election on. I think the last week has been a demonstration that, you know, when there's an election happening and the campaign's on, Premier Horgan's all about young people, but he doesn't hesitate to, you know, casually insult young people who are struggling and who've borne a very heavy load during COVID. So I actually think this is a really important moment and a really important opportunity for my party to demonstrate that we take very seriously younger people, the challenges they're experiencing, the future they want to build, and I'm committed to carrying that into the leadership race.
Well, let's touch on that for a moment. The past couple iterations of the BC Liberal Party, I don't think has really spoken to younger people as much as it could have. Besides just your general age and demographic profile, what do you think you have to offer and how the party needs to change in order to appeal more to people like us?
Yeah, it's a great question, Scott. You know, I think there's a lot of different component parts to that. Firstly, I think that especially for, you know, for a younger generation, there are qualifiers and disqualifiers in politics, and you quickly disqualify yourself as a candidate or as a party. You know, for example, if you don't take climate change seriously, you know, for example, if you don't have, you know, respect for who people are and for, you know, for their rights. So I think it's really, really important just to pass the values test at a minimum. But I think, you know, bigger than that, I do genuinely believe that younger people in BC, you know, are really looking to have options. I think that no matter what political party you ascribe your beliefs to, if any, it's really important that people can see themselves reflected in the system. So I think on a partisan level, the BC Liberal Party has a lot of work to do to build a bridge to the next generation of voters, you know, and to bring them into the party, frankly, bring them into the caucus. But equally, I think, you know, if you're under 45 and you work in the private sector in BC right now, you don't have a heck of a lot of representation in any party. I think that, you know, to their credit, the NDP has done an admirable job of renewing their party and of building a party that is demographically representative of what today's BC looks like. They've got some smart MLAs in there who have, you know, good, solid perspective. I give them that. I give them good marks for intentions most of the time, good intentions. But I think, you know, again, if you're from a young family that's struggling to get by, you're deciding whether to stay here or go somewhere else, you don't have a lot of options. You don't see yourself represented. In particular, if you're, you know, one of the many younger business people, entrepreneurs, business leaders that I talk to, you just don't really see yourself or the issues and challenges that you're dealing with reflected in the kinds of conversations that are happening in the legislature, whether that's around technology, whether that's around housing affordability, whether that's around childcare, whether that's around any of those issues. So I really do fundamentally believe that our, you know, our political class across the spectrum needs to understand and represent all generations, and we need to make sure that we build the capacity and understanding to navigate, you know, a 21st century economy with all of the opportunities and all of the very real challenges that come with that.
Well, let's get a little more specific in there. You mentioned a number of the challenges, and we know them so well. Housing, we're talking about people not being able to get into the market if they don't have, you know, six figures handed down to them from their parents or in-laws. you know, you can't buy a house unless you have over $1 million or more in Metro Van. I think it's 1.5 now. What do you do? Your premier tomorrow. What are you doing first?
Yeah, great question, Ian. I think there's a couple of different component parts to that. There's obviously, there's a policy component that I think we ought to talk about. And I think it's very important that we delve into that. But there's also in some ways, almost a philosophical aspect to that, right? What I see, especially in our generation, is there's a real sense of just a loss of hope. Right. When you think about kind of the American dream, right, which is work hard, play by the rules, and you'll achieve success and respect. Right. Now, the reality is that in America right now, social mobility is broken. And it's actually very, very difficult for people to get from the bottom of the ladder to the top in their lifetimes. But social mobility still exists to a much greater degree in Canada. Now, I think there's a real sense, and I believe this goes beyond partisan politics. There's a real sense, especially for younger people in BC, of just struggling and feeling as if the rungs on the ladder are broken or they're further apart and they're harder and harder and harder to reach. And I think that if that is a reality from a quantitative perspective, if it's a reality on the ground, that you're seeing reflected in numbers in terms of people being unable to make up down payments or being unable to get into the market, then that's obviously a very real policy reality. I think it's also a big P reality, a big P political reality, and a small P political reality, which is if hope is lost for that next generation, then, the incremental young, smart, talented people who are going to make up our labor force, or the incremental entrepreneur, a small business owner, the person that's going to start something, build something, do something, make something, they're going to do it somewhere else. You know, that tech CEO is going to say, you know what? I'm just going to move my company to Calgary, or I'm just going to start it somewhere else. That young, young, smart family is going to decide, I'm just not going to do it here. And in part, that has an effect for all of British Columbia, but there's also a really interesting and I think very significant dynamic happening where you've got this outwash plane of young professionals who are basically fleeing the unaffordability of Vancouver and the surrounding area, and they're going elsewhere. And we're going to have to deal with, number one, the loss of the kind of, the collisions and collaborations that happen when people are densely clustered around enterprise, around innovation, around entrepreneurship. But you're also going to see a second order affordability challenge that is going to hit outlying communities. So all of a sudden, somebody who's got a bit of equity from an apartment in Vancouver is moving to a smaller community, right? They're moving to Seashell, they're moving to Langford, they're moving to Nelson, they're moving to Prince George. And you're actually going to see a knock-on effect where they're bidding up the prices of single detached housing in those markets, which again creates an affordability challenge for the next tranche of people who otherwise would have bought those homes in those communities. And you've just got these kind of, this extremely complex system that is the housing market, and we can't, there's no magic bullets.
So I think that's a good job of identifying the problems. What's kind of the next step in terms of making progress on there and restoring that hope? What policy levers are you thinking about pulling?
Great question, Scott. So, I think first we obviously have to identify the range of different policy and non-policy levers that exist and the ways in which they do and don't fit together, right? So you've got to recognize that, you've got municipal, provincial, federal, private sector levers all moving and sometimes pulling in contrasting directions. So I do think that before you start pulling on strings, you have to recognize that every string you pull moves three other strings and has knock-on effects. So, to use a simple example, there's a major challenge, I think, happening in terms of insurance costs, right? We basically have a situation where, for example, a comparatively older rental stock is becoming virtually uninsurable unless it's, comprehensively renovated. So what's happening there is the owners of those rental apartments can't meet their objectives in terms of capitalization rates. They end up selling it. It ends up getting knocked down, rebuilt as more expensive housing. So instead of moving down the property ladder and becoming more affordable over time, as it goes from being brand new rental housing and down, we're actually moving properties up the ladder because you have those kinds of perverse incentives. So you've got to address issues like that. I think that it is blindingly obvious to everybody, almost anywhere in British Columbia, in particular in the Lower Mainland, that we have an absurd backlog and bottleneck around permitting. It blows my mind, having been through some of those processes, how insanely inefficient and slow it is. And the reality is that, number one, that is preventing supply from coming on stream where it's needed and creating a massive lag effect. Number two, that's also driving up the cost of actually delivering that housing. You know, so I talk often about kind of housing and childcare as being very similar in that regard. And my wife and I have some background running childcare. You know, so if it takes an extra 6 months or 8 months or 12 months to get permitting done, you're not getting supply onto the market, number one. Number two, you're driving up carrying costs. And, you know, number three, there are often significant other costs associated with that red tape burden, whether that be just the, you know, dealing with all of the flood of paper, or whether that be, you know, silly rules like the requirement to have a wheelchair adaptable powder room in a house that's got 30 stairs leading up to it that, you know, it's going to be virtually impossible to ever convert for somebody who uses a wheelchair. So I think what it comes down to is, you know, how can we at a provincial level provide capacity, resources, do some coordinated work around modernizing and expediting permitting processes? I think that's a very, again, blindingly obvious step that we could be doing more on. I think there's more we could be doing around transit-oriented development and around the way we do basically, you know, statutory zoning of density cones around rapid transit stations and capture some of that lift to go and fund transit. I think there's a wide range of different levers that we can do. But what we need to do is stop with, you know, kind of the finger pointing and the scapegoating and actually get people constructively into a room trying to figure out how the different policy tools can actually fit together to actually achieve the objectives that we're trying to achieve, which is, you know, to make sure that we've got housing for people.
Well, let's pivot a little bit and talk about some of the other challenges the province is facing right now. You alluded to some of the premier's comments that we've mocked on this podcast, and everyone on Twitter has mocked recently about young people leading the rise in COVID cases over the past week, over the past weeks. But beyond kind of the snide and trivial marks there, what's your assessment of the province's handling of COVID, of the pandemic, and what do you think should have been done differently?
Great question, Ian. I think the first thing we have to do is we have to kind of define terms here, right? We have to figure out, what are we actually talking about? Are we talking about handling of, you know, the initial handling of the crisis? Are we talking about the handling of, you know, vaccination? Or are we talking about the handling of the economic components, both the economic components during the pandemic and obviously preparation for subsequent recovery? So I think, you know, frankly, there was good effort made on behalf of all parties in the legislature to work together in order to address the pandemic initially. I think that you know, maybe we got a little bit smug as a province and a little too self-congratulatory about how well we were doing. And there were some measures and some missteps that we obviously did not take. Things like rapid testing in long-term care facilities and innumerable others that, you know, that we could go on about. So again, I think we got a little bit complacent in that regard. There were measures that should have been taken that weren't taken. I think that now we're seeing some bungling of the vaccination process, and I think that's causing a fair degree of frustration. But I think, hopefully, God willing, you know, we're closer to the end of this. But, you know, it really feels as if we're taking steps forward and taking steps backwards. Now it feels like we've got a ways to go. We're seeing the emergence of new variants. We're seeing new challenges. We've got record-setting, you know, cases today. So I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to get through this. Let's be really honest. The reality is that by the time I would become the leader of the opposition, or hopefully, you know, the premier as leader of the BC Liberal Party, what we're going to be dealing with is economic recovery. And we're going to be dealing with, firstly, we're going to be dealing with, how the heck do we pay for the massive amounts of money that we've just spent? we needed to spend money, just to be totally clear. It's very, very important we did that, that we do that, that we're looking after people and families. I don't think that, austerity at a time like this is in any way, shape or form the right approach. But the reality is we're going to have a giant, massive debt burden, and it is going to be people like us on this podcast right now that are going to be paying for that debt burden for a very long time. And we're going to be paying for that debt burden, with an increased level of personal debt. I think you've got to look in very, very real terms at the possibility that we're going to have sort of a K-shaped recovery, where you've got, some folks that are coming out just fine. And you've got some folks, especially, millennials and Generation Z, who have just been hammered by this thing financially. If you look at the 2008-2009 recession as a precedent, it took 10 years for the 18 to 24 year olds at that time to overcome the economic scarring, the long-term job market effects, the long-term effects in terms of wealth creation and all of those things. So you've got some folks that are going to be in real tough. And we got to make sure that we are, building back jobs, for example. Like, we've just seen the retail, the storefront apocalypse of restaurants and retailers being, just chewed up by this. That's going to be a real challenge where we're going to need to figure out, okay, what do we do in terms of job creation, in terms of bringing back those jobs? The reality is younger people are going to be entering a labor market where they're competing for jobs rather than jobs competing for them. Their financial circumstances have been compromised. And that's why we're seeing a really high level of distress financially and very serious mental health issues, particularly among young people and particularly among women during this pandemic. So we're going to have to do a lot in terms of economic recovery, in terms of taking care of people, in terms of making sure that as we get back up and running, we've got the tools in place and the right environment in place to really get going on rebuilding our economy. And I think the one final thing I'd say on that is everything was not fine before this pandemic happened. Everything was not fine before COVID happened. I mean, our country was virtually grinding to a standstill because we had rail blockades happening across the country. We had very serious division and discord. We had very serious economic issues. We had very serious challenges before any of this started. So we really got to get our eyes on the prize in terms of rebuilding.
In terms of rebuilding, how do you see that going? Kind of what steps would actually be taken by a BC Liberal government led by you?
Yeah, great question, Scott. I think there's a variety of different areas. I mean, government doesn't create businesses. Government doesn't create jobs, right? Government ultimately creates the conditions in which investment can happen. I'm a big believer that number one, we've obviously got some traditional sectors of strength in our province, some of which are coming on hard times, some of which have come under a lot of social pressure. We've got to make sure that we've got kind of a strong bedrock economically. But I also think we need to be really serious about, for example, growing our tech sector here. And, the truth is, I was talking to a tech CEO the other day who made the point, there's no tech sector without tech workers, and there's no tech workers if they can't afford to live here. So it's recognizing that all those pieces fit together, right? That people have to be able to afford to live here. They have to be able to get childcare. They have to be able to have, the physical and social infrastructure they need in order to be here in jobs or creating jobs. So I do think we have to get very serious about supporting our tech sector. That means, I think, being very serious about post-secondary education and training. I think it means, frankly, trying to get to the point where we have a government that is seen as understanding innovation. Fact of the matter is, we are the province that took 7 years and two governments to figure out how to regulate ride sharing. I mean, Mogadishu had ride sharing before Vancouver. So, that does not send a very strong signal to the marketplace in terms of this being a place where you should come and innovate or build an innovative company or do innovative things. That's not a one-sided defense of ride sharing. My belief is we spent 7 years creating uncertainty for both incumbents in that marketplace and for a new entrant, right? So we're going to be processing a tremendous amount of change as a province and as policymakers, whether that is change to unlock job creation and innovation, whether that is addressing climate change, whether that's geopolitical change, we need to have people in government, frankly, on all sides, who are equipped for a 21st century economy and who are equipped to try to create the conditions where people actually want to build businesses here and stay here.
The language you're using is very familiar probably to a lot of BC Liberal supporters, the sort of pro-business, you know, make things easier to do. But I suspect there's also not just like the hard left who would not agree with you anyway, but people who are in the more middle, probably the people who were lost in 2017 to the BC Liberal Party, who, you know, probably got frustrated after 16 years of BC Liberal rule and what was seen as corruption, the money laundering scandals, those kind of that wearing down of the trust and the kind of loss of vision that I think people felt that Christy Clark didn't have in 2017 that maybe she did bring in 2013. How do you build back trust in the BC Liberal brand when, you know, in a couple weeks, the big names of the party are going to be dragged before the Cullen Commission and who knows what other dirty laundry is going to come out?
Yeah, I mean, Ian, that's a fair question. I think that trust is central here, right? I mean, there has a couple things. Firstly, you build trust through authenticity, right? You build trust through talking to people, being willing to talk to anybody about anything, being open and honest about issues, you know, not trying to spin them, not trying to focus group them, just actually being who you are and having authentic relationships with people. That's something that I've done a lot of in my work. You know, it's just building genuine, authentic relationships with people, even if you don't agree with them, right? It's trying to get to underlying interests rather than just positions, when it comes to, you know, negotiating, complex issues. So I think that, you know, there's got to be a bit of that. I totally agree. There's got to be a lot of work put into, building or rebuilding trust, with voters, especially middle of the road voters. I've been completely open about my approach to this leadership. I believe that we fundamentally need to go and win back that middle of the road voter, win over that, you know, that 30 something, you know, suburban parent, win over folks that really have not felt as if they've been welcomed into our party, whether that be, you know, people and families or whether that be industries that really haven't felt as if, they were being welcomed into the tent. So I think there's a lot of that work that needs to be done. I do really fundamentally believe that, you know, people like to be treated like adults. You know, they don't like being talked down to. They don't like being spun to. They don't like being told what to think. So I think we really just have to treat people with respect. And, you know, if we're dealing with difficult issues, let's have real conversations about them. Let's not pretend, for example, that we're going to solve housing with magic bullets or oversimplified things. We actually have to be prepared to talk about the fact that this is a massive, complex, multivariate market that is going to respond rationally and irrationally to different interventions and incentives. So how do we actually make sure that we're, you know, we've got smart, savvy people dealing with these things? I mean, fact of the matter is, I'm never going to be the smartest guy in the room, and I'm not trying to be the smartest guy in the room. My belief is build a bigger room, try to get more people into it, and try to make sure that they're actually heard. Try to make sure that you're hearing dissenting voices, you're hearing people that don't agree with you or don't start by agreeing with you, and that you can actually have a real, earnest, serious, you know, evidence-based conversation. You know, just naming a policy something you want to achieve doesn't mean you're actually going to achieve that thing, right? I mean, I don't think that, you know, for example, we've seen this ridiculous situation happening with Las Margaritas, you know, where we're effectively driving small business out of business and destroying the character of neighborhoods because we've got sort of a lack of nuance or a lack of a lack of appropriate gearing in the way we're doing some of our tax policy. That's been a problem for a long time, but we're seeing it play out to a greater extent, you know, with the absence of, you know, across the board split assessments for business and residential situations. You know, you've got all kinds of things along those lines where, like, the reality is to solve these problems, you actually have to dig into the details, and you have to be able to do that in a way that's not just about slogans and political posturing.
Somewhat related to that, don't think it's a state many people's noticed that the province seems to be more divided along rural-urban lines than it used to. 20 years ago, the BC Liberal Party was actually pretty much won every seat in the province. But after that, it was much more of a combined party that did well in the cities and did well in the rural areas. And that has been slowly going away over the past 20 years. What are your thoughts on kind of how to change that and kind of depolarize along those lines?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Scott. It's one I thought about a lot. I think, you know, there's sometimes this urban-rural divide, it's artificial, and we kind of let it be more than it is. But a lot is changing in that regard. Firstly, I do think that, you know, that my party needs to reassert urban and suburban leadership. I think that, you know, there are a fair number of voters who you know, probably with some fairness, feel as if we really stopped driving forward with, you know, with leadership in urbanism. I would like to have seen, for example, I've been a champion of the Broadway subway line in Vancouver for a very long time. I mean, we were talking about that when I was a student government leader at UBC in 2005. We were talking about it in, you know, 2011. It's just, I think we've ended up kind of not getting stuff built. So the NDP government, frankly, has had the opportunity to kind of to reap the benefits of a BC Liberal government or a series of BC Liberal governments that put in place the plans to build urban infrastructure and then did not get those plans completed. So now you sort of have an NDP government cutting ribbons and putting shovels in the ground on plans that were originally conceived but not enacted by a BC Liberal government. It is going to be, let's be honest, it's going to be a political challenge for the BC Liberals to now leapfrog, you know, catch up and assert, I hope, a more visionary and ambitious urban agenda that is going to make sure we're addressing, you know, the infrastructure needs of urban and suburban communities. We're making sure people can get around. We're recognizing that, you know, if people are achieving affordability at the cost of a massive commute, that's not net, you know, that might superficially come across as affordability, but it's taking time. It's, you know, it's pumping, you know, it's pumping pollution into the air. It's taking people's time away from being with their families. So, you know, I think we really need to be more assertive in an urban and suburban agenda. That certainly includes affordability. It certainly includes, obviously, housing directly. It includes transportation infrastructure. It includes childcare. It includes, you know, all of those other components. So I think we need to really, we need to strengthen in terms of urban and suburban leadership. We need to be very assertive in going out and trying to rebuild support with, again, this, you know, let's call it the 20 to 45 year old suburban young people and families who I really think we need to build a bridge to. We need to extend an olive branch to them. We need to rebuild trust with them and convince them that we're the party that they should be at home in.
All right. Well, we'll let you go in a second. I just have one more meta type question to close off. It's still very early in this race. Right now it's you, it's Ellis Ross. Arguably going for slightly different angles, though I think both presenting new faces to the party in different ways. I'm curious what you're looking for from this race more broadly. Like, there's rumors of people like Aaron Gunn, who would be pretty controversial if he entered, or Kevin Falcon from the previous era. You can comment on them specifically, or just like, what are you hoping to get out of this race, win or lose?
Yeah, that's a great question. What do you want to see? Great question. So, I mean, I think that for the party, I see this race as an opportunity for us to both demonstrate and expand the breadth and depth of the party, both in terms of candidates that are stepping into the ring and in terms of supporters that we're bringing in. Hopefully, we're inviting new people in who've not felt welcome or who haven't felt excited about the party, you know, in a while. So again, to me, that does involve bringing in that next generation of voters. It involves bringing back people who have drifted away. I think that done right, we'll have a great breadth of candidates who come from different parts of the province, who come from different backgrounds, who come from different parts of the party. And if things go well, I think that we'll have a constructive, healthy debate where, you know, we're bringing new ideas into the mix. I do think that what BC Liberal members are looking for, and what, you know, even people that are open to voting BC Liberal are looking for, is they're looking to move forward, right? They're looking to the future. They're looking for a new approach. They're looking for new energy. They're looking for new ideas. I think they're looking, to turn the page. And I think that certainly is what I'm able to offer and bring to the table. I think that frankly, people that have been around and involved in the party for a long time, they're looking, for someone they can pass the torch to who won't burn the house down. So it really is kind of this interesting balance in terms of what the membership overall is looking for, what new potential members who might give us a second look as a result of my candidacy or somebody else's candidacy are looking for. And I think more broadly, on a hopeful note, I genuinely believe that this race is about more than just who leads the BC Liberal Party. Firstly, it's about how does the BC Liberal Party get renewed more broadly, because we're going to need dozens of new candidates who are going to, in many cases, become MLAs and opposition critics or cabinet ministers in the next election. I think it also is really an opportunity for us to have a conversation that needs to be had around, where our province is and where it's going. So I think this is significant, not just for people who are supporters of the BC Liberal Party or potentially supporters of the BC Liberal Party, but for the province as a whole.
Well, I think we've probably taken enough of your time tonight. But before we let you go, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you, find out more if they want to get involved? All that information.
Yeah, you bet, Scott. Absolutely. So we're at www.gavindew.ca. That's GAVINDEW.ca. You can find me on pretty much every social media platform that exists with the handle Gavindew. You can sign up for our email list. Frankly, you can throw us a couple of bucks if you like. Most of my friends are, paying mortgages and rent and for diapers. So, if you've got 10 bucks burnt in a hole in your pocket, we'll happily relieve you of that and put that to good use on the campaign. If you want to be helpful to us, you can sign up to become a BC Liberal member and you can vote for us. Vote for me.
Thank you, Gavin. Have a great evening.
Thanks very much for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Moving on to our second segment, Politicoast Unbound. So I sat down with Jeff and James from the Unbound podcast to talk about what their project's about and the future of the BC Liberals and the Conservative Party of Canada. Jeff, James, welcome to Politicoast.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Hey.
Good. So we just finished what felt like a slightly marathon recording session for your guys' podcast, all about cities, local politics, housing, which I encourage our listeners to go check out. But we wanted to have you on our podcast to kind of find out what you guys are doing, talk a little bit about where you see the future of conservatism in Canada, the center-right, and all that. So before we jump into that, why don't you give yourselves a brief introduction of both yourselves and the podcast?
Go for it, Jeff. Start.
I'll start because James has a much more interesting background. So my name's Jeff. I'm a lawyer and practicing in Vancouver. I have kind of loosely been involved with the Conservative Party since my university days, but not kind of in an official capacity and not, I've done some door knocking and stuff like that. I've actually voted for both the Conservatives and the Liberals. I voted for Justin Trudeau once, so I'm an idiot, but I'm not kind of a total partisan. I have a real interest in, I think James can speak to this too. I'll probably speak for both of us when I say that both of us are pretty dismayed with where we see politics are right now in general. We're especially dismayed with where we see conservative politics and how it's just completely not center-right politics, not even necessarily conservative politics, how it's just totally not aligning with the needs of newer generations, how it's failing to connect with younger voters, and how I think it's totally missing the boat on a lot of policies. So our podcast is relatively new. I think this will be episode 10 this week. So we're about 2.5 months. And that's kind of what we try to talk about is those issues. We want to fearlessly challenge conservatives and center-right thinkers to confront some of their biases and justify their positions, which a lot of times we don't think are justifiable. James.
Yeah. Wow, you did a good job talking about our podcast. Loved it. Yeah, name's James Robertson. I am a former military veteran or naval officer, special forces officer, about 15 years. Approximately 5 years ago, got out while I was doing an MBA. you know, and from that until that point, if it wasn't foreign policy or defense policy, you know, didn't really think much more about politics and that. I have bounced around the political spectrum a bit, both on much similar as Jeff, kind of a family that goes, you know, from liberal to conservative. Although I did do a bunch of university and you know, high school in Calgary during the reform days. And, you know, there's a lot of times I think very highly of Preston Manning. I think my family was largely probably liberal at that time, maybe just being contrarian to the overall conservative movement in Alberta. But no, got out 5 years ago, moved to Vancouver, and slowly started getting more and more involved in politics. At that time, I was a little bit disillusioned with the federal conservatives, definitely not happy with the federal liberals, and decided to go into municipal politics. And the reason I got involved in municipal politics through my MBA got thrown on to me, wasn't expecting it, a project for my writing project thesis or whatever, or organizational management project, they call it, a bike lane project. And so MBA, you know, think you're going for business and you get instead a thing about bike lanes. And from up in that point, pretty much everything was all for me was about international security and all that. And I, you know, being a military guy, not really having a clue beyond that, in some sense, was like, oh, I'm going to go be like a Warren Buffett and learn all this cool business secrets and all that, which for your military veterans out there, you don't get that from your MBA, so just forget about it. You had some other cool stuff. But yeah, I got this bike lane project. And it really showed, I went off in the deep end, learned how deeply streets matter, how we design streets, how we design neighborhoods. And then that from that, like local politics, you know, it really tickled an interest. I got into it pretty deep, got involved in some of my local groups in the community I just moved into called Port Moody, suburban community of Vancouver area. And eventually, you know, wanted to run municipal to get kind of involved in things that would support the community. Well, lo and behold, little did I realize this little innocent municipal politics is much more a big thing connected to federal whatnot. And I got involved in politics there. I saw that there was a lack of center-right, a voice for center-right. And long story short, went provincial, didn't make it. And just continued to see that there wasn't a voice. And so Jeff and I met there, and that's where we got. That was way too long of a talk. I've got a lot to
say. Yeah, so I think the only thing I should probably let our listeners know on, in addition to all of that, is in the 2020 BC election, you ran as a candidate for the BC Liberals, right?
Yep. Yeah. And we got our asses handed to us by the NDP provincially. So it was
a fun time. I was there.
It was fun. During a pandemic, no less. So
and now you're on the former candidate to podcaster track. So what got the podcast going?
I just felt like there wasn't much of a voice on the center right. We started looking around for podcast material. And a lot of times when you start looking for material, you'll find it down south in the States. In Canada, not so much. And I think Jeff really spoke well on it, is we thought that there was like, we felt that a lot of the spectrum had gone pretty far left, that there's this big wide area that you can say is the center that a lot of people aren't speaking to. And a lot of times that, you know, we have found that potentially a Tory center right whatnot isn't that attractive to younger people. So we kind of wanted to go down that journey and find out why, and what would, you know, a center right alternative look like that would be attractive to young Canadians up through municipal, all the way up to federal. And so, you know, we're trying to have some conversations. We're pushing people to say things that are may not be as popular and all that, but to just push the paradigm a bit and feel comfortable being able to talk about issues. And some of it might be, I'm not saying offensive, but push or poke the bear of people that hold left-wing views. But I think there's actually, and Jeff would probably agree in this, a lot of poking the bear has probably been on the conservative side.
We haven't, I think probably that's true. We haven't, well, I'm less plugged in to actual politicians than James is in some of those networks, but I haven't had my head ripped off by a conservative yet. So I'm looking forward to that day.
Yeah, so I've been listening to your podcast since you guys started, and I'm really enjoying it and the conversations you've been having on it. And yeah, that's definitely my view on it, is you've done a lot more, I think, critical look at kind of the conservative movement than really kind of poking the other side so much. And James and I
made a joke between us the other night that we should actually do a podcast where we hate on the NDP and the Liberals, just so people know that's actually how we feel. But
you don't want to boost up your partisan bona fides a bit, or people will think you're NDP plants.
We're the furthest thing away from that, at least I can speak.
A couple years back I volunteered on Michael Chong leadership campaign for the Conservative Party, and I
love me some Michael Chong.
Oh, great MP. Really, really wish he'd won, but I did see firsthand how difficult it is for there to be that kind of reasonable right of center voice in a lot of spaces. So I really think it's important that you guys are having the conversation you have, and that it's an ongoing discussion, because it really does feel like, just in general, the center-right is a bit aimless at the moment, unsure of itself, having an identity crisis. The way I see it is the big kind of political project ever since Reagan, Thatcher, anything, has kind of reached its natural endpoint, and the local versions of that are similarly just at a bit of a loss now that there doesn't seem to be a net step that's particularly viable, and particularly in the context, I think the pandemic has really highlighted that, and there's a period of renewal that's needed. And I kind of love to get your thoughts on kind of where that renewal should come from and what should be thought about, particularly at the local level, but we can touch on Canada a bit after. But in terms of BC politics, the BC Liberals are going through a leadership race right now. Kind of what are your thoughts on where the party is, where it needs to go, and kind of the changes and reforms that are needed?
So, I mean, I have a theory on this, and I've probably said it on the podcast before, but basically, I think that center-right thinking is at a bit of an inflection point. I think that starting from Reagan, there was a pushback against, you know, the very, very kind of free market push that Reagan had. That led to Clinton and a whole bunch of things through the 90s and aughts. And I think that what's happened since 2000, especially since 2008, is that debate has been settled in a lot of ways, is that there is going to be a robust state. There are going to be social services that are going to be provided. And the state has an important role to play in that. I think that is kind of a settled argument. And I really believe that. A lot of conservatives, I find, are still fighting the battles of the 80s, 90s, and aughts, early aughts, which is like, we've got to shut down Medicare in the US, or we've got to limit, you know, Social Security, or we've got to limit, we've got to privatize medicine in Canada. You know, that would be the kind of one of the Canadian equivalents. And from an ideological perspective, I'm sympathetic to some of the points that get made in those discussions, but it's not going to win you elections, and I don't think it's the way forward. I think the way forward is figuring out how to apply the powers of the state in a responsible and measured way to allow people to fulfill their own individual pursuits, whether that's starting a business, whether that's having a family, whether that's, you know, doing whatever they want to do. And I think that's the big hurdle, is there's this big generational gap, whether you're talking about the BC Liberals, where you're talking about the federal conservatives, where there's an old guard that is still kind of fighting the battles of their youth. And then you've got a younger generation that's stuck in the middle because they're saying, like, I don't really care about, about the capital gains tax rate because I can't afford to invest any money because I'm trying to save up to buy a house and those people are now completely out of the political conversation. And we talked to last week, Jen Sanford, who I think is a great description of a kind of an ideal person, mid 30s, that the conservatives should be thinking about. How do you bring women in? How do you bring younger people in? And the existing way is not, it's not doing it. It's not cutting it, boys. So we got to reinvent things and rethink things a bit. And I hope that the process the BC Liberals are going through now brings some of that in. And, you know, I know Gavin Dew has thrown his name in the ring. I hope that, you know, he brings younger people's voices in. I don't know if that'll be the case. And I don't know if they'll be accepted by the overall party. But I hope that that's the case in the BC Liberals. And I hope that that's the case in the federal conservatives as well. I'd say less than 50-50 chance that it'll happen in the federal conservatives. And I'm more hopeful for the BC Liberals. But time will tell.
Yeah, it's so I'll just riff off of that and focus more on the provincial. So BC Liberals, center right party for BC. I think one of the challenges for the BC Liberals, and I'm going to say something that might not be that popular to say, is one of their biggest successes is that they basically made the BC NDP have to almost become like them in order to win government. So I don't think what you can see some people, you know, being critical of this is the NDP, at least for their minority government, they're now a majority, so I expect things will start changing. We're pretty close to being center in a certain way. And I think they'll start shifting left because they have a mandate. They can. Whether or not the voters go for that, we'll see. You know, BC's a pretty, I'd say right now, BC's a pretty left-wing province. And you know, Horgan, if he's careful, he can just slowly continue to nudge left and left, continue to build out the public sector, because that's generally what I see what the NDP is, what it is, its raison d'etre is for continuing to expand the public sector and be a voice for the public sector. But right now, there isn't much difference in terms of the progressive messages and whatnot. And I get this from a lot of the conservative element of the BC Liberals, is they're like, are we just trying to out progressive the NDP now? Because it's really hard to find room. And so what that means is the leaders coming in, who's going to provide that voice of differentiation from the BC NDP? It's going to be hard. I know there's, we've got Scott Ellis. He's a proud Indigenous man. He's been a leader for his nation up north. He's been a voice for the resource sector. I've heard really good things from behind the scenes in terms of him working with others. I think he's going to be something attractive because he provides a different perspective from what we've generally heard from or being pushed. I think in the Lower Mainland is a kind of a left-wing element of the Indigenous community. He will provide a different aspect of that. We have the younger gentleman, Gavin Dew, who's trying to bring some energy to it. He's talked a lot about focusing on family-based policies. I'm going to be interested to hear that. And we've got the other gentleman that's kind of been floating around here and is definitely, you can tell he's true blue, is Aaron Gunn, and he's poking the bear, right? And he might be that differentiation voice or whatnot. I'm interested to see what he does or whatnot. And there's going to be there's more voices, there's more people there. Has there been anyone else that's joined that you guys are aware of?
Well, Kevin Falcon's name that keeps getting floated.
Kevin Falcon.
Apparently,
yeah,
doing a lot of behind the scenes work building a campaign team.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't, again, like when I got involved in the BC Liberals, I didn't know a lot of their history. Kevin Falcon has a lot of history there. I did see him speak once and I was really impressed by how he spoke. And I think to go against the NDP and Horgan is a charismatic man. He's a good, you know, I'm going to give him points. He's a good speaker. His communication team around him knows how to message and they play the media really well. Big points to him. You're going to need someone that I think you're going to have somewhat of a charismatic speaker, someone that's strong in there, someone that's willing to fight. And I'm not a pro any of these camps. I'm not saying that, but I remember seeing the one talk with Kevin Falcon, not knowing his background or anything. And I was like, you know, I'm impressed by that guy. He's got energy. He knows how to, you know, he knew how to play the crowd and all that. So he's another person. And like you said, I think I've heard he's got quite a bit of organizational power behind him. So I think number more names to come up, but it'll be interesting to see what they come up with and how they can differentiate from the NDP.
Yeah, I think the differentiation question is going to be really key because the 2020 platform was not very differentiated at all beyond a few key details. And Aaron Gunn is certainly differentiated from the NDP, but in a way that I don't think is actually going to resonate with the people that you need to win. So how do you guys see that the need to both chart a different path while still being appealing to the lower mainland ridings that are the key to victory?
So, I mean, just to kind of an interesting point of comparison, I think the NDP have really struggled in the last couple of federal elections because of something similar that happened is that when Justin Trudeau came out and said, you know, I don't have a budget goal. I'm going to spend the deficit. I don't really have a target for it. I'm going to spend whatever I need to spend. It really put the NDP out to water, being like, well, how do we differentiate ourselves now from the federal Liberals? And they've struggled with that ever since. I think that there's a similar kind of thing that's happened here. I don't know whether we talked about it in this conversation or the previous one we just had, but one of the BC Liberals' greatest successes is that they've brought the BC NDP to be more centrist than they were. And now as a result, because they are no longer in power, the BC Liberals have a hard time figuring out what the hell they do differently. If it was me, which it isn't, but maybe it should be. But if it was me, I would be looking at ways that urban younger voters are impacted by the provincial or the municipal government that can be affected, where there could be a positive outcome in their lives through a change that is comfortable within a conservative outlook. So, for example, in our last conversation, which you should definitely go listen to, we talked about regulations inside municipalities. It seems to me that it's totally within the BC Liberals, you know, mandate of smaller government, pro-entrepreneurial, less regulations to actually force the cities to cut some regulations. And they can go and they can say, this is how we're going to get more housing built and get housing affordability done. And that's through a reduction or a streamlining or a consolidation of regulations and put that to the cities to get done, or either do it yourself or put it to the cities to get done in an adequate manner. So I think that's what you've got to look out for. The younger voters have no interest in voting conservative, and they don't have a lot of interest in voting BC Liberal. So you've really got to find ways to win those people over. And housing is a good one, I think, that fits nicely within their comfort zone. Daycare may be another, but that's probably another a little step further for them, outside their comfort zone.
That gets a little tougher, but I feel there's definitely a space for a reformed version of the center-right that does see a more active role for the government, not necessarily an all-encompassing role, as I think people on the left would more see it as, but as a highly competent and able entity in the areas it occupies. And I think efficient. I think this past year we've seen the benefits of a lot of state capacity, and where when we don't have it, say being unable to close down a restaurant for 3 days that's breaking public health orders, to use a very current issue, it just becomes a problem. And we don't necessarily want everything to be, you know, run by a ground corporation, but maybe there's a role for the government to do a little more that helps both the private sector and the civic societies better fulfill their roles too. And I think there's a spot for that, but it's going to take, I think, a fair bit of political maneuvering, or maybe not maneuvering, but political work to bring that older generation on side to where I think the younger generation is on this.
Yeah, it will be, the leaders will be bringing different policies for sure, but I'm also going to be very interested to hear, the leadership candidates, their plans for organizational capability, because I think really the ability to take on the NDP will start with the next municipal election, which I think is a year and a half away. It will start there. The NDP and a lot of NDP, light teams or whatnot, I think right now are pretty heavily invested or represented within councils and school boards. Center right, if it wants to have a voice, it's definitely going to have to start there. And I will say this is I think the NDP got by with the last 3 years with a lot of projects that the BC Liberals had been building and pushing for a long time, and they basically got to kind of cut the ribbon, and it was great. That's not going to hold much longer anymore, and it's really going to be what they create and design over the next 4 years. And right now, they've got some significant challenges with drug overdoses, homeless camps. If they can't fix some of those situations before the next municipal election, I think it's going to be a big factor. And I also think there's a lot of now young, pretty idealistic activists that now have seats and a stronger voice within the provincial NDP. And it's going to be a hard job for Horgan to keep that party disciplined going forward. I think COVID has helped with that. But once we're past this horrible plague, that's going to be more difficult, right? And the protests and all that with energy projects, all that stuff is going to come back. And can he keep his party disciplined and his young activists in line? We'll see. Because if he can't, I think at some point, it's not really, is the Liberals providing a, or whatever they're going to call themselves, a different ideological party per se. It's just something that's normal. Right? It's that, provide me something that's normal, provide me something that's just going to manage my tax dollars well, make government
boring.
And
I think the BC Liberals have to really put forward a vision of what they want to do and not just rely on the NDP to screw up various things. Because I think that that's a trap that the federal conservatives fall into a lot. And we've talked to other people who, say basically that the federal conservatives are just the party that gets elected when people have had enough with the Liberals and need to put them in the timeout zone for a little while. And I think the BC Liberals run a risk of falling into that category as well, unless they can really put forward a viable alternative proposal. It's not a matter of Horgan is bad, the pandemic was handled poorly, and the pandemic isn't going to carry weight, remember, because the provincial election is not for another 4 years, 3.5 years. So the pandemic is going to be 3 years in the rearview mirror, hopefully, by then. They're going to have a lot of time to rewrite history and kind of reframe things in their favor and move on to other issues. And, the BC Liberals have got to not rely on, you screwed this thing up three years ago in a very difficult circumstance. I think that I think, to be honest, as Horgan is making them and the NDP are making a mess of COVID, it should be a total non-issue in the election if the BC Liberals are smart, because it's water under the bridge at that point.
Yeah, I think that's quite likely the case. You very briefly touched on the federal conservatives, and I'd love to dive into that a little more, but I know we're a little time crunched. So I guess 30 seconds, what do they need to do? What's the problem? How do they change it? Just very briefly, because I am conscious of your time commitments.
James, you go first.
Polls are looking really bad right now. And I keep hearing that an election's close. I have a hard time believing that now with the horrible scourge and new variant. Numbers starting to go up with COVID. But if it is, the conservatives need to you know, put on their work boots, stop infighting, and get after the game, because there's a lot of ground that they can fight against the federal liberals, and there's a lot of alternatives that they can provide. And I think O'Toole has been trying to articulate that. It's a hard ship to maneuver, you know, but he has indicated that he's a man of change, and he's trying to bring that party more to his center, more to attract where the votes are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that James hit it, and we've talked about it on our podcast a lot before, but you've got to put the hammer down on some of the infighting within the groups. If the headlines are being consumed with whether or not your party believes in climate change or conversion therapy or whatever, you know, else is abortion, whatever else is on the docket, you're not going to win any elections in Canada. So you got to figure out a way to kind of establish yourself either as a leader, and it's okay to have those people in the party, but you got to find a way to sideline those debates and make them not the core identity of the party, because to be honest, it is not the core identity of the party. It is the core identity of a select group of small people who are very active within the base. And everybody else wants to move on from it and to actually do things. But we keep getting dragged into this infighting. We need to get out of that. We need to find a way to target, same with the BC Liberals do, younger urbanized voters. And I think in the federal level, childcare is a great one to do that. So focus on the family. And there's a great way, and we've talked about this before, about bringing social conservatives in on the focus on the family, but that include that to more than just gay marriage and abortion and whatever else they're worried about. Bring that up to, like, how are they going to get to, you know, are the schools good enough? Is the transit good enough? Can mom go back to work? Is mom getting the right amount of leave after, you know, after having a baby? Is dad getting leave? You know, in situations, is dad getting enough leave? How do we deal with that? You know, I saw an interesting policy around moms getting leave after a miscarriage. That's a really interesting way to think about kind of supporting families through difficult circumstances to grow their family and, you know, take and be able to kind of have kids move our country forward.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in that kind of pro-family, not as a euphemism, but pro-family as a really being about the
being
family.
Pro family.
Yeah. And I'd love
taxation
to dive
as a family unit is another good one. I think taxation as a family unit makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Families as something to build a politics around, whatever form the family takes.
Yep.
And being more open to the other versions of that are a little less traditional. But as much as I would love to dive into it, I know you guys have to go. So I'll recommend, I think it was the Ben Woodfinden episode, where you guys talked about that a lot, which was a good listen.
Yeah.
I'll refer our listeners to that, and they should absolutely check out your podcast. But
and we're happy to come back and talk about it. I'm sorry I'm a little crunched for time tonight.
Well, we went long on yours, so it's all good.
I owe you time now.
Share the content this week. There's so much more I'd love to talk about this, but we'll have to cut it short here. But before you go, why don't you let our listeners know where they can find you in your podcast?
If they want, I don't know why they would, but if they wanted to find me, I'm on Twitter.
I can enjoy it.
At G Costello, CosteLoe. And our podcast is Unbound, Fearlessly Exploring Issues That Matter. I will put a link in the description, but you can find it pretty much everywhere you get podcasts, and give it a like and 5 stars. And you can link it too. I slipped my tongue up, but I can fix that. You can like it, link it, do whatever you want.
Boom. Yeah, I don't know my Twitter handle. You can just you'll find me if you follow Scott. I like a lot of his urban tweets on development and all that. So if you see James, you know, a guy named James liking his tweet, that's me. You can follow me on that. Jeff
He's
said
a good looking
it.
Guy
Jeff,
with a
Jeff
shiny
has
head.
Said it all. Yeah, shiny head.
Awesome. We'll throw a link to your guys' podcast and all of that in our show notes and where they can find you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.